se tam cítit na pohár, když jsi vrát se svědomí.
Afternoon, you've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel, and today Waiki Wang is here in the studio.
Hello.
Thanks for coming down, Waiki.
Of course.
It's great to see you.
Yeah.
Let's see. It's May 1st. So
May 1st.
2018, a pinch and a punch, the first day of the month, no returns, rabbits. Do you know that?
What is that?
That's a family. My mom says that. So I'm.
Where's that from?
I think it's from England. At least that's what mom
says. It does sound like that. And you say mom, so.
But it's also very, I feel like it's somewhat violent too. A pinch and a punch the first day of the month, but said cheerfully.
That's very British.
Yes. Waiki, you're on book tour for the paperback release of Chemistry, your debut novel, out with Knopf and now with Vintage paperback.
Right.
And I just took a look at your tour, and so you're sort of more on
the
end of the arc and you're heading to Boston.
Heading to Boston tomorrow, then I have Miami next week, but that should be the end. All these things, I feel like with the events, they're sort of trying to space them out. So I have some events in the summer in New York, but it's not, I'm not going anywhere, which is
because you're based in New York City now.
I'm based in New York, but if I were based someplace else, I feel like I would be always going to New York.
So then this is a good, it's working out.
Yeah, it is working out. It is working
out. And you're not too far from Boston.
I'm not. It's a 4-hour train ride.
So you can get back if you need some the old streets of Boston or so, right?
Right. Well, New York is such a crazy city, I think. It's just so crowded. There's so many people. And the sidewalks are way too small and there's always trash everywhere. But it's very vibrant. There's so much culture. It's like a mixed bag.
It's true. And there's always something happening.
There's always something happening.
Which is also good and bad.
It's good and bad. I think it's good for some people. Like for me, I don't really notice it and I just kind of do my own thing. But for a lot of people, they feel like they get very distracted when they're in New York. They have to go everywhere. They have to see all the things. You know, there's so many...
The pressure to be keeping pressure, up with the
sample
latest.
Sales. I don't think I've ever been to a sample sale in my life. But
for some reason, that sounds like Sex in the City a little bit.
A little bit. New pop-up restaurants that you have to try. And sometimes I look at the address and I'm like, that's in the East Village. I might as well just go to Miami.
And what part did you choose to live in? Like, what's your
neighborhood? So I'm on 110th in Manhattan. So it's like, it's upper West Side / Southern Harlem, almost. So it's at the border. So it's very fun. It's very, there's a lot of parks, which is great.
Because for your dog.
Yeah, for my dog. I have a dog.
Do you want to give a shout out to your dog? Is
my
the dog in the picture that you use for the Glimmer Train essay.
Yes. You have my Glimmer Train essay?
Yes.
Wow.
I wondered if we could talk about this. It was a great
gosh.
One. You know what? Before we get into it, Waiki, because I can see how this is going to go. It's so easy to talk with you. I'll read your bio from Chemistry.
Okay, great.
The book that's the debut novel here on the table with us, and then we'll get back to the conversation. Weike Wang is a graduate of Harvard University, where she earned her undergraduate degree in chemistry and her doctorate in public health. She received her MFA from Boston University. Her fiction has been published in literary magazines, including Alaska Quarterly Review, Glimmer Train, and Plowshares, which also named Chemistry the winner of its John C. Zacharias Award, a 5 under 35 honoree of the National Book Foundation, and also now a Penn Hemingway Award winner and a Whiting Award winner. Weike currently lives in New York City, which we have just been discussing.
Have you lived in New York?
No, I wish. I've been there a little bit.
It's a good city to visit, I think.
I think it would be hard to... It's challenging so for me to live in.
It's so hard. I when I moved there, I was sort of in shock of how hard it would be. Just
what brought you there?
So we moved. Well, my publisher's there, and I had finished my grad program in Boston, and it was the jobs there, right? There's more jobs there. Columbia Public's, public health school is there, and I think it was me trying to entertain the idea of if I went into public health, but I could also write and do both, maybe New York would be a good city. And I think when you're young and a little bit maybe, not that wise yet, you think, I just have to go to New York. I have to sort of live there.
It feels like New York City or L.A. I feel like L.A. has the has the pull, too, right
the
now.
The young. Or San Francisco. San Francisco.
But
New
who
York.
Can afford San Francisco?
That's right.
The very wealthy young. I don't know.
The children of the young.
So what's your favorite park? Which is the, maybe dog park. Is that the best qualifier for in your neighborhood?
Yeah,
like,
I think, is that I need access to, so what I really like about New York is Central Park. So I really need access to that. And we're, me and my dog are a few blocks away from Central Park, which is nice. Because that's really the only greenery that we see.
It's a massive park, though.
It is massive. They have a lake. They have a zoo. I've never been to the zoo.
I've walked past the zoo a few times.
You have?
Yeah, but not inside it. So connecting to the book here, one of the things I noticed about what you do, Weike, is that you are able to move across many time and space in a very short real estate on the page of the book. And there's a scene that I'm thinking about, which I think is in definitely the last third of the book, where the dog is taking the narrator for a walk. Then it becomes this strange there's a hailstorm, a person gives an umbrella. There's this very clear scene that we're in with the narrator and the dog, and then the dog lays down in a puddle, and then the next line, and the narrator is putting a gesturing so traffic goes around the dog, so the dog can remain in the street in the puddle, and then we're at the shrink's office.
Yeah.
And I think the last line is more, I should have obviously had the page before going into
I know
this
to talk. Hopefully
listeners out there will or soon will, right? but then we're in the office with the shrink, which is that character's title name.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And we're talking about the moon.
Yes. Yeah. I think I kind of like the way that the fiction jumps. I've always been drawn to that sort of fiction. That's just generally my natural state. I think it kind of comes from my inability to stay with one event for a very, very long time. Doing chapters, traditional chapters of 10, 15 pages, following this one scene, describing everything. I find that, when I read, I don't notice that, but sometimes I'm like, it feels a little tedious on the reader because sometimes you can just imagine what this might look like. And I feel like every reader is fairly smart that they can make the jump to another scene or make the jump to a thought process. And because this writer, or not this writer, this narrator is, I wrote this as first person. I, as a narrator, wrote this as first person. It's easier, I think, to jump in first person. So you can kind of go into her thoughts, out of her thoughts, to another scene, to backstory, to the future, back to a thought, back to the present. And it's a very easy. And I find that as long as you give context, the reader is really never confused. I do think it asks a lot of the reader to follow you. But I think it's actually pretty fun. which I really like. So I think I like reading that kind of prose. So this, I know this book has been sort of compared a lot to Jenny Offal's Department of Speculation, which I had read a while ago, and it, that also does these jumps.
I haven't read that one.
Yeah, it's a very good book in terms of, you know, making these sort of jumps in scenes and thoughts of a narrator. But a lot of great writing, I feel like, does that. You know, I was under the tutelage of Amy Hempel, who's a short story writer, and she does a lot of those jumps in her short stories. And another mentor of mine, Sigrun Nunez, does a lot of those in her sort of memoir style, like faux memoir style prose. So I think it lends well to thinking, a narrator thinking, like a meditative process. And part of this book is her coming of age in her own thoughts. So I thought it worked well with the structure in that, you know, you wouldn't be in one scene and then you have to go to another scene and then you have to go to another thing.
Because we've got that immediacy in her head in a way.
Right.
So Amy Hempel is a friend of the show.
She is?
Yes. Yeah.
And how did that happen?
Oh, a lot of people come through Michigan, Mikey.
Oh my gosh.
And she actually is one of my heroes of writing.
So you met her?
Yes.
So she was sitting right here.
She was, actually, indeed. Yes. That very spot, if not the very chair.
Wow.
As you can tell, things don't
The very water mug?
No, that dog mug I brought in for you. Although she would actually love that. And next week I'll be talking with Jim Shepherd, and
oh my god, can you say I said hi?
I will certainly say that.
Okay. And his editor is my neighbor. Yeah.
So you'll probably get to see him at some point.
I think so. I mean, I got, you know, Liz, my neighbor, I said, oh, you know, Jim Shepherd? I saw he not acknowledged you in his acknowledgments. Can you just tell him I said hi? And then she was so kind and she gave me his email, and I just sent this great, you know, this email. I was like, I love your work. I've been reading it for so long. I admire the well-researched aspects of everything in your work. Truly, I feel like every single time I read a short story by Jim Shepherd, I'm like, why am I even writing short stories? I don't feel like, you know, he's just so talented.
He makes this whole world deeply believe.
Right.
Which is so interesting that saying that you admire this, because it's almost, at least I've only read the first story in the latest collection of his short stories.
Mm-hmm.
But it's the complete opposite of the spare cut mm-hmm. style mm-hmm. that I so admire in your novel Chemistry.
Right. It's completely different. I think you admire, you know, I admire writers who can do something I can't. And Jim Shepherd, I can't do that. So it's just like, how do you do it? It's part admiration, part envy, I think.
And why do you think, for like getting back to your writing, that do you read it out loud also to find the places to cut? Like when you're drafting, how much of...
I read it out loud a lot. But I don't notice it. I think only people around me notice it. Like if I'm in the library or working from home, somebody will say, you're talking to yourself. But I don't notice it when I'm writing. I think I'm just muttering it.
But why do you think that's important to mutter?
I think you have to hear it. You have to, you know, a lot of my teachers have said that every writer has to hear a period coming a mile away. So you have to know when the sentence is going to end. And that's intuitive. I mean, it can be taught, but it's also partly intuitive. And another teacher of mine said there's been like many blind writers, but there's never been a deaf one. So the idea of being able to hear your words and to see how that sounds is really important. So reading work out loud is something I advise to students. And I don't mean reading it out loud in front of everyone, but just reading it out loud partially. You get to hear things that, you know, maybe rhyme that you didn't want it to rhyme, repetitions that you didn't, things that go on for too long, lack of pauses, that sort of thing. I think dialogue works better when you read it out loud. So you can, you know, would you actually say something like that? So I do read a lot of things out loud to get the voice right. Voice is something I care about a lot.
Well, let's take a short break, and when we come back, let's talk about Voice.
Of course.
Today on the program, Wykie Wang is here, Chemistry, her debut novel. I'm T. Hetzel. We've got the Liz behind the glass. We'll be right back. Good afternoon. If you're just joining us, I'm glad you did. Wykie Wang is here. Her novel, Chemistry. During the break, we were talking a little bit more about how lovely Amy Hempel is.
Yeah.
And how you had the opportunity to meet Amy in undergrad.
Yes.
When you weren't even thinking of yourself as a writer. Should we pick up there?
Yeah, of course. So I think I had a really nice experience in that when I went to a college in which I was very fortunate to have met great teachers and mentors. That was one of the great aspects of going to that kind of school. And I just thought for fun, let's take a writing class. I've always enjoyed writing. I thought it was a nice thing to do on the side, and I was taking all these pre-med classes,
and it was definitely on the side.
And I was in Amy's class for sort of intro fiction, and I had no idea, you know, embarrassingly I have to say this, I had no idea who she was. I had never read any of her work, because I think I was a sophomore, so you know, I was 19, right? You don't really know anything when you're 19. And I went into the class. I think I showed up late the first day. She looked at me. She got me to sit down. And the class started. And I really just enjoyed the way that she taught. She was very generous with her students. In hindsight, now I think about it, she was very generous with her students. She had this thing where, you know, we went through and talked about what was positive and what worked, and then we went through the critique, and she was just such a great listener of other students, and just a generally great teacher. You know, you should read this you should work on, let's set up, you know, one-on-one. She's just so nice, and I think in hindsight I appreciate this more because I had no idea how famous she was, right? And then later on, sort of, you know, a few classes went by, and I just you just start to hear things, right? Oh, she's you know, she's like a writer's writer. I had no idea what that meant at the time. And, you know, did you know that her first story, blah, 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 and her, like, collection. And I think at one point I was like, I'm just going to Google her, because, you know, I don't really Google all of my professors. I Googled her. And I think I was just completely floored. because by that point, for some reason, I'd convinced the class, let's all go out for bubble tea. And then so Amy Hempel and the class went out and we got boba. And like mochi ice cream, and I just thought this was so normal, but in hindsight I was a little bit mortified that I took her out to boba.
No, why? Sure she loved that, and yeah, that's what was important,
yeah,
to her. Yeah,
so she was, it was great, and I think the year after I took, you know, advanced fiction with her, It was a completely different experience in that everybody was sort of on a different level. And when we were learning, we were writing, and there was a lot of other grad students in the class. And then it just felt more of like very similar to how my MFA experience felt, the nice classes in the MFA. So everybody was very kind, considerate. We had this teacher who sort of guides the conversation but doesn't take over the conversation. I've kind of kept in touch with her ever since. Of her dogs, you know. I like that she writes about dogs. Jim Shepherd writes about dogs too. He has what does he have? He has
beagles.
He has like four or three. Oh, yeah. He has a ton of beagles.
Kind of a handful of beagles.
Yeah. And I think the idea of writing about dogs is so sweet. Which is why eventually I got a dog. I mean, not because Amy had a dog, but the idea of, you know, being around dogs. So I don't think I would have written without her encouragement. I think at the beginning I needed encouragement. I think anybody at the beginning needs encouragement. And that's what she gave me. And then it sort of catapulted me into doing the MFA. And she read, I think, the manuscript of this and was very kind to give me her support. So in all, I have nothing bad to say about her.
And so you mentioned the MFA program.
Yeah.
And that was in Boston,
mm-hmm.
Boston University, right? And, mm-hmm. But you were also doing, biostatistics?
Yeah, I did. It's part biospecific. It's a cancer epidemiology, which is a little bit of biostatistics, a little bit of public health. It's mostly just big data analysis. So I was doing that, which I don't think I was supposed to, but it's sort of water under the bridge, right?
but as a PhD student.
Yeah.
And then concurrently,
I was doing the MFA.
Like when you were partway into that program.
Right.
You also applied to
the MFA.
I mean, this is kind of an amazing... Are you tired of talking about the
no,
story?
No. I mean, not at all. I think it's important that, you know, this young generations of writers know that to become a writer takes work. It's not just, you go to a beach house and you write, right? Funded by this invisible hand. It's work and you have to pay your dues, right? And when I signed up for the MFA program, I just didn't have the luxury of quitting something that was so practical, like my doctorate. So I thought, okay, I'm going to give this class, I'm going to do the MFA. And I just told myself, if I really love this, if I really can succeed in it, I'll succeed in this no matter what, right? So I was succeeding in this, whether I'm doing the PhD, whether I have a job, I'm gonna do it no matter what. So
the writing, like
yeah,
you would
the
write
writing, the
no
writing.
Matter what,
I would write after. No matter what. So I did it because it was also with grad school, you have a stipend, right? So that's important to live. You know, money is important, even though artists don't always say that.
No, it is.
It is really important, right?
Yeah. A fellowship gives you money and time
because you need to eat and you need to have a roof. All these things help with writing. So I just felt that I couldn't give up sort of the quote unquote day job or the practical aspect or something as impractical at the beginning as writing. And I really encourage and, you know, tell my students who are now young writers, if you're going to go into this field, you have to be very aware of the implications. You should be aware that it's going to be work and you should be willing to put in it. And it was also a way of doing them concurrently became a way of for me to discover that I think I'm not bad at this. I think I can do it with the pressure and I think I can do it successfully. And I think I can sort of maybe bring something new to the table in a way that I feel a sense of accomplishment for. And it's a field that I can grow in. So I needed those two concurrent, that kind of pressure cooker environment for me to discover that. Because I think when you're under pressure, you just start to, for me at least, I think a little bit more clearly. I think, okay, what are the necessities? What do I need? What do I not need? And how can I make this work in the most, conducive way?
And it seems like it also forced you to be highly organized because in we mentioned Glimmer Train, you've got a great personal essay, 100% rejection rate, which as the essay goes on, it becomes 98 point something percent.
And this is
98.9.
That was after I had gotten some things
published. But in this essay, you talk about, I think it's every other day you assigned the chunk of time 9 to 2 p.m. for writing. And that's how you got through the MFA program. And then the other days of the week, they were for teaching because you were also tutoring and then doing the PhD work.
Right. Yeah. I'm very good now at managing my time and structuring it. So that's what I do now. And I think it just gives some sort of structure, right? So many writers need structure, need deadlines. For me, if I treat it like a job, sort of part-time job, it helps me get through it a little bit more. So you're logging the hours, quote unquote, even if every word you write doesn't end up in the final manuscript.
But maybe it's giving you time to find those words.
Right.
Because you're there doing it.
You have to write through a lot to find a few that work.
Are you finding that with the current project? Like, what's happening now for you? Because this is, as we mentioned earlier, this is the paperback release of Chemistry.
This is the paperback, yes. So right now I'm working on this novel. I think I'm halfway through, a little bit past halfway through. I've written... If you think about the quantity, I've written probably a whole novel, if not more, two novels worth of stuff that I'm always just trimming down and trying to polish. But the story is sort of a long-term friendship between two people and following that and how that it grows or doesn't grow. Where are the chunks of separation? When do they come together? That sort of thing. So, you know, in Chemistry, this is more of a love story. There's friendship in there, but the main thread is that of a love story and also family love. In this other one that I'm working on, it's more about the friendship between just two college friends. You know, they meet in college, but what happens later on in life and how that develops. I think friendship is not really written about that much, especially not in America. I know in other countries it is, like Europe, but here...
Are you thinking of like Elena Ferrante?
Yeah. The Thomas Mann. So I feel like, but in America, it's not a huge topic, friendship.
No. In fact, a student of mine is creating something on Instagram to address that. Like how they always say, how you met the person you love or so.
Now it's how you met your friend.
Yeah. In fact, I hope, so check that out, everybody, because Julia's got that online.
Right. But I think the friendship relationship is also very complicated because it has to grow to encompass... you know, your different lives, right?
And that usually is different places.
Different places, and why people keep in touch. And what part of a friendship, I think, is also, you know, love in a different way.
Like completely.
Family love. But there's also some sort of attraction, right? There's curiosity. There's attraction.
And I think admiration.
Admiration.
There's something you see in the other that you can also believe in.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm sort of trying to think about how that friendship can go into love or come out of love, that sort of thing, because it's a boy and a girl friend, but then it's their friendship for many, many years. And do they come together or do they never come together? That kind of question I'm dealing with, because I actually have a lot of friends who are guys who I've been friends with for a few decades. Well, you know, I haven't
That's
been
weird
long
to
for
say.
That many decades, but I guess 2 decades.
Right.
And I just wonder, we've never explored other avenues. We've just been friends, but this friendship has sort of changed in many ways. And I've seen them get married and have kids, but we're still friends. But obviously it's different. So I think it's something interesting to explore.
And so that's the current project.
Yeah.
And is it also with, let's see. Oh, you know what? Let's take a short break. and then
okay,
and then we'll come back and talk more.
Okay,
today on the program, Weike Wang is here. Chemistry, the book on the table with us. I'm T. Hetzel. You've got Living Writers. We'll be back.
Tonight I'm gonna have myself a real good time. I feel alive.
Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Weike Wang is here. Chemistry, the debut novel that's been, what's it like now to have the Penn Hemingway? Because these are all more recent that have
these
just
are very recent.
Happened, last right,
month.
Weike?
Yeah.
So, and the Whiting Award.
The Whiting.
So how does that change the game a bit? Or, I mean, maybe not that. Okay, let me rephrase that. Because it's already clear to me that you would be writing no matter what. but these are some of the things that encourage you in a way that I can only imagine is super encouraging.
I mean, I think, I guess I'm just so pleased that this novel did well. With debut novels, sometimes no one is sure how they will do. So with this one, when I wrote it, and whenever you're writing, for me at least, I think, who's going to read this? I don't know who's going to read this. I guess I read it. And I guess I'm just so pleased that this has been well received. I have readers. And it's sort of being recognized on a more literary level in terms of, what I was trying to accomplish artistically, which was to create a readable story. Sometimes I feel like literary fiction can almost go on the side of hard to read in terms of following the narrative. I wanted to write a readable story that also pushed the reader to maybe experience different form, different structures, different voices, with also tidbits of science, which is just fun. I think it's fun for the reader to maybe learn some of the things, just because science is sometimes painted as daunting.
And it's so naturally woven into the pieces and also used for often humor.
Mm-hmm.
So imagine that.
Right.
Science as humorous as well.
Yeah.
Or complete pathos.
Right.
For example, when you bring up Marie Curie Haber.
Yes.
Is it Haber?
Haber.
Oh,
it's the Haber process.
That was...
It's a little shocking, right?
Yes. So that was not funny.
Right. I actually went down this rabbit hole of doing research on other chemists just because they're so interesting, the lives of other chemists and their personal lives and how they can kind of implode because their professional lives are this this unstoppable momentum of research. And sometimes these scientists just do research to just do research, but they never think about the implications. And then you have Nobel thinking about these implications. So I think I wanted to write a story on a on a level of giving these scientists a little bit more of a full picture, right? Not all of them are objective individuals who are always doing the right thing, right? Sometimes they're just human beings, which is what you can say about everybody, right? Who are in professions like these.
Or just everybody, period, really.
Everybody, period.
But sometimes we don't want to allow certain...
Right. And I wonder why. I wonder why that is with scientists, that we don't sort of allow them to have this human aspect to them.
Yeah, because you'd think that to be human would make you more trustworthy.
Right.
Not less so.
Right. And I think it's just because science is sometimes held at a distance so often that we become a little bit scared of it. And if it, you know, if it's unfamiliar, then we think, oh, they must know what they're doing. They're the serious sort. They have to take their work seriously. And right. I do think scientists take their work seriously, but that doesn't mean they always think through the implications, right? You know,
right.
We have certain...
Or that certain pressures don't force people's hands in ways that they shouldn't
be. Exactly.
Because there's a character in Chemistry that is put in the pressure cooker in a way that isn't healthy.
Right.
Forges
right.
some right. statistics.
Forges data.
Some data.
Yeah. Which is, I think, very common. I mean, not that you know, but it is common. I think once you go into the field, you sort of always hear stories of that happening.
Yeah. Even at quite high levels of like plagiarism, in fact, where you think, how could that even,
right.
How did it get so far
right.
to this
right.
or so lauded in a particular way until,
right.
Well, you know what, do you mind reading some of Chemistry
of course,
so that we can hear what we've been talking about a little bit?
So I'm going to start reading from the middle, closer to the middle of the book. I guess the only context, should I give a little context? Yeah.
Great.
The only context is that the book starts with a question. So the narrator's boyfriend slash potential ex-boyfriend, Eric, has just asked for her hand in marriage, and she's not sure. So that she's not sure at this point either. And she's currently quit her grad program in chemistry, and something has happened to their apartment that they have to move out. So it's not been a good couple of months. The optimist sees the glass half full. The pessimist sees the glass half empty. The chemist sees the glass completely full, half in liquid state and half in gaseous, both of which are probably poisonous. At the start of grad school, the safety officer warns us that working in a chem lab can shave 5 years off your life. Some things will never leave your lungs, he says, silica, for instance. Oh well, I think, who needs to live that long anyway? Because the inn has no kitchen, we have been eating a lot of granola bars. I don't understand when I read on food packages that something is chemical-free. I immediately take offense. Everything is made up of chemicals. To say that something is chemical-free is to say that the inside of this package is an absolute vacuum. Why would I pay this much for a vacuum? Also, how much granola is too much? The only difference between a poison and a cure is dosage. Drink too much water and you will die. Inhale water and you will die as well. Chemists long ago used to stir their reactions by hand. I am being quite literal. They used to check for doneness with one finger in the pot. The mark of a good chemist used to be the number of fingers you had. The fewer, the better. It showed more experience in the lab. Eric has all 10 fingers and all 10 toes. I joke that he must not be a very good chemist, and he gives me a genuine laugh. But then the job offers come in, including Oberlin, Ohio. He puts a doily on my head and dances me around the room. The moment we're back in our old apartment, he asks the first question again. Say yes, I want to. He asks the second question. Come with me, I want to. Then say yes. Isn't it enough that I want to? Eric has never jogged until now. I think it is to minimize his time at home with me. Outside it is warm, and joggers are rampant along the river. But Eric is the only one doing it in jeans and waterproof boots. Thank you. So that's a little bit, but in the middle.
So why did you pick that section to read, Waiki?
So I used to read from the beginning just because I liked the beginning a lot. And then reading a hundreds or so times, you get a little tired. And I like that section because I think it pulls together, you know, the the weirdness about chemistry. There's so many weird stories in chemistry. And also just her and Eric's relationship, that they're going through this very awkward, long breakup. Just when you've been together for years, sometimes the breakup is not so clean. And just what that long breakup looks like. Some days are great. And, like, you know, that scene in the end, but then the day after is not so great. And then it's a great day, and then it's not so great. So, you know, it's such a back and forth. But it's not without its humor, I think. And that's what I like to capture with these stories and how I write, is that even if it's devastating, I think it can still be funny. Because most of the time, even if I'm devastated about something, I will still laugh in that same day or that same hour about something else, right? So that's what makes it so painstaking, is that you suddenly think about this heartbreaking thing, and then you find humor in something else a second later, and then you think about that aspect again. And that's what makes it almost very bittersweet.
How did you find the voice for this? Like, knowing that you wanted to write in the first person,
Right. So first person for me just comes a little bit naturally. This second one is in third person. You know, stupidly, I thought, I'm going to challenge myself.
Your current project.
Right.
That makes sense, though.
Yeah. I think, you know, I say this and people are like, no, I think that's a good idea. But during it, I'm like, oh, my God, I love first person so much more. Why am I doing this to myself?
Do you have any first person stories on the side that you kind of do as treats?
Oh, yeah.
Like as
valves? Of course. So I have this, I'm writing these vignettes about this, like, disaster sort of narrator who's planning her wedding, sort of in these very short paragraphs of what happens in this wedding process.
That's going to be hilarious.
Yeah. But it's more of just a, like an outlet for me. And I do that in the first person. And it's just easy for me. It comes a little bit more naturally.
Might you send that to McSweeney's or
maybe? Yeah. That's actually not a bad idea. For this one, the voice had, I think with novels, I'm a little bit more careful in terms of controlling the voice, editing it down, making sure there's a right balance of humor, but also poignancy, making sure everything is a necessary word. Just because I spent so much time on the novel. So this one I spent a lot of time on. And then the current second novel, I'm spending more time on to make sure everything fits in an organic way. So I think when I go into find a voice, everything in a way sounds like me. It's hard to not sound like the writer, because the writer is writing it. But I think each piece does have a different tone, right? So with this piece, the tone is, there's, you know, it's lighthearted, right? But there's also a very dark undercurrent for the story. But with other stories, I'm on, I might have a different undercurrent. But the voice, I think I prefer maybe shorter sentences, simpler constructions. I really value white space when I write. Maybe stopping a section before I over-explain. I'm always afraid of over-explaining I write what I wish to get out. And then sometimes I'm like, no, they'll figure it out. I'm just going to delete that section. And then it sounds like, oh, I expect the reader to make that jump when I probably wrote the connection. I just took it out.
Because you felt like in the balance or how the rhythm of it was moving,
right,
that you could take that piece out and it would make it stronger.
It would make it stronger. I think it also helps the reader pay attention.
It's definitely more engaging, then you're active.
You're actively thinking about the story. You're actively thinking about how did that jump happen. And sometimes, you know, that's what I like to do when I write a paragraph. I connect it very linearly. And then I think, okay, they know this, cut. And then it sort of adopts that voice in a way of skipping, which I sort of like.
Well, and I think because when we mentioned it earlier a little bit, but I feel like it's a generous thing to do as the writer, because you're leaving space for the reader. Because in good writing,
the reader has to be there. Right. And, you know, the age-old advice of writing to your smartest friend or writing to the smartest reader, I think once you explain something the reader has already figured out, you lose the reader, right? Among other ways to lose. It's very easy to lose the reader. So I think over-explaining can do it, you know, not having sympathy for the characters, that sort of thing. But I find that the reader likes it when they're thinking, because that's the dialogue, that's the conversation that you have on the page. And if you can see the narrator thinking on the page because the reader's filling in that blank, that's all. I feel like that's a very rewarding experience when I read other writers.
And it seems to also get you as the reader closer to right. that narrator.
Right.
So
yeah.
you're sort of pulled in.
Yes.
Very
yes.
close.
Yes.
And so you're going to be reading at Literati Bookstore.
I am.
And I wanted to mention that Hillary and Mike are the owners. Yeah. They brought it back, a bookshop back to Ann Arbor, because we started losing some.
Losing bookstores?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Which is a conversation for another time, because this used to be a really big bookstore town. And now Aunt Agatha's is closing, a mystery shop that's been around for a while. So very grateful for Literati being here. And Hillary brought your book to us, I think last year, was it, the Liz, for the summer read? And so my first impression of your book, Wiki, was that the Liz loved it. It got like, I don't know, more than 5 stars. Like,
Five and a half.
Triple thumbs up. Yeah. So, and then it took me a while to get a chance to have it on my reading radar. So when you came back to town, I was like, this is my chance. And I love it. I'm so
great.
Glad that you're
Thank
here.
You.
And we'll take a short break and then we'll come
of course.
Back. And so today on Living Writers, Wiki Wang is here. Her novel, Chemistry, as you can tell, we're really glad she's here. And we're glad you are, too. We'll be back. Welcome back. You've got Living Writers. I'm T. Hetzel. Today on the program, Wiki Wang is here. Her novel, Chemistry. We just got to hear some of it. So glad you all are listening. And Wiki, thanks so much for coming by the studio today. It's been so fun.
Yeah, this has been great. And
come back anytime. Okay.
I would love to. I mean, I came here in the morning and I've just been walking up and down State Street, seeing you of them.
Kind of exploring a little
kind
bit.
Of exploring because I think I've been to U of M, but you know, during sort of like the admissions process, like going to college or like grad school or you know that kind of thing, I've never kind of come back here to enjoy
as a person, right?
Yeah,
as a writer,
which is so weird because I interviewed here for med school. Isn't that bizarre? Yeah, completely different experience.
Oh, I believe it.
Yeah,
we'll come back anytime. Just feel invited.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not for med school.
Of course.
Not for med.
No. I think med school was interesting. It was like, I had a great time here for the med school interview. I don't remember anything about it except for the interview question about like if somebody drowned, who would you pick, like your dog or your spouse? Like that was a question.
That was a question?
Yeah.
Is that normal when you went to the other
ones? I think so. It's how they want to know how you think. So they want it's not whether you have a right answer or a wrong answer, it's just you have to reason through why you would pick this versus the other. But then I was just thinking the whole time I was reasoning through, everybody's dead. If they're drowning, they're dead. So why am I even talking about this? Like, can you imagine in a movie? Let's think about this. So...
Well, I'm so glad that you didn't let that process deter you from coming back. But Wyke, with chemistry, we've been talking mm-hmm. about the voice.
Mm-hmm.
And I also wanted to say thanks for picking the music for
today's
show.
Oh, you're welcome. It's kind of a mix. I have sort of the rock classics that I really love, like Queen. And currently I've been listening to a lot of Zeppelin. And I just like that when I, work out, when I run, but also when I just want to get out of my own head. I like a lot of classical piano pieces. Because sometimes when I write, I like the just the rhythm of it. It flows. It's like a really long run-on sentence, which is nice because I don't always write run-on sentences. And sort of just modern dance music, that helps me. And obviously the Beatles piece at the very beginning was from this, Dear Prudence is from this book. And I just like that piece. It's deceptively simple, which I think is how what I like about the best prose, I think, is deceptively simple, is that you listen to it and it's a very simple melody, but there's so much going on at the same time.
Many layers,
yeah.
and undercurrents.
Mm-hmm.
So Wyke, we mentioned briefly earlier too that this is a love story.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, the only named character is Eric is,
yes.
is the boyfriend and then,
yes.
then ex-boyfriend.
Yes.
But it's also a love story for family.
Yeah.
And the mother and father mm-hmm. are so present
mm-hmm.
within
mm-hmm.
this book.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk mm-hmm. a little bit
yeah,
about this
of course.
Family love story and,
of course.
And about, I don't know how it affected the narrator,
mm-hmm.
Because in some, I Hurt For You, I guess
mm-hmm.
maybe we could
mm-hmm.
start there.
Yeah. So I Hurt For You is a phrase that comes at the end of the book, and it was how I wanted to encompass the love that these parents, or she feels for her parents and her parents feel for her. I often think that, Asian American families are stereotyped as being very difficult. I mean, that's it. You sort of, they're difficult. They never say, I love you, period. And I think that you say you can hear a period from coming from a mile away, but I just don't think that's a period. That's a semicolon. And there's so much beyond that, right? There's so much, what does that love mean? Even though they don't say I love you, doesn't mean they don't love you. There are different ways that they say it. There's different ways that they feel. And I think I Hurt For You is trying to encompass the sacrifice that parents, especially these parents, are making for your kids. You know, every parent can understand that you sacrifice for your kids. But these parents have sort of gone to great lengths to sacrifice for her, for this daughter. The mother essentially become this completely different person so that this daughter can be a full person. And that just tears up on people. I think that weighs heavily on people. And the family, love story is how she's maneuvering with these these quote unquote difficult parents, but also embracing that aspect of it. Respecting that difficulty, because there's so much complexity behind it, and also so much history. You're talking about like thousands of years of culture behind this kind of thought process and this kind of love. And she's just scratching the surface of it with just coming to a new understanding of her parents. So many, I think, coming of age stories are about understand me. And I think for this one, I wanted her to understand her parents, which is coming of age. You start to realize your parents are not, they don't need to grow up to understand you. Maybe you need to grow up to be the adult and realize that they're actually doing okay, and they're also human. So that's how I wanted to kind of encompass this coming of age, is that it's a mutual respect, understanding, admiration. And there's that moment in the end where she sort of realizes that she could not do what her parents did, even though she, was a relentless critic of them. She couldn't do it. She sort of hits an age where she's like, I couldn't do this. And that becomes a very powerful moment for her in the book.
So. And I've loved talking with you today. I wish we had more time. Because I think the next thing we would talk about is fear and courage and how that's working in the book. But maybe we can say that's for our next conversation.
For next conversation. I will be back.
Wyke, thank you so much for
coming
today.
You're welcome.
Today on Living Writers, Wyke Wang, her novel, Chemistry. I'm T. Hetzel. Thanks for listening. Until next time.
Time flies by when the night is young. Daylight shines on an undisclosed location. Location. Bloodshot eyes looking for the sun. Paradise delivered and we call it a vacation. Vacation. Thank you.